This is the second half of Best Policy's two-part interview with Jonathan Sacker, the co-head of the insurance practice at Brian Cave, Leighton Paisner, and an experienced litigator on behalf of insurers and reinsurers. In the first part, we focus on the UK COVID-19 landscape from the perspective of the industry's potential liabilities. In the second half, we look at overseas markets, and in particular the US, both the world's largest insurance market and also, of course, its most litigious. So I start by asking what he expects to see in other jurisdictions.
Yeah, so I think this is what distinguishes COVID from anything else I've seen in my lifetime as an insurance and reinsurance lawyer. This is the first time that we've had a global, the word pandemic, but a global catastrophe of anything like this magnitude, where the experience of most countries is going to be one form or another of the same. And so you can expect similar losses, obviously subject to the extent to which the population or the businesses are insured, similar kinds of claims coming out of almost every jurisdiction, which is why the aggregation issue becomes even that much more complex. When you're looking at aggregate globally, or you're talking per country or per continent or whatever. So I can see that we've got that international perspective too. And then you obviously are in some jurisdictions which are more litigious than others. So you can see the common law jurisdictions being potentially an issue, and particularly the US, where there will be mass litigation of one sort or another. I haven't seen a solution proposed such as the regulated here is proposing, but of course there are the attempts on a statewide and even a federal level to introduce legislation that will determine that policies that might otherwise have exclusions actually do provide cover. Now, there is a question of whether that is acceptable under the US Constitution, but the more interesting part of that, I think, is sort of what I've seen so far is that the state legislation that's been proposed would effectively alter the coverage, either by way of excluding, rather removing the pandemic exclusion, or providing that there is cover even though there's no business interruption. But the proposal is that whilst the insurer will have to pay those claims, the insurer will be compensated by effectively a levy on the market in that state, so that it won't all fall to the insurer whose policy has been varied. It'll actually be, it will fall to all of those insurers authorized in that state. And so that's one proposal, one route. So effectively creating a fund or a guarantee fund, as has been done in other specific situations in the past. We all know the kind of disputes that are likely to follow in the US. If you've seen some of the numbers of some of the claims and some of the names we saw many, many moons ago, even as early as the days of the World Trade Center, some of the same claimants are out there properly seeking recovery, one might say, only be successful if there is coverage under their own policy, or if the state steps in, which appears to be the case, or the requirement for many of those cases to succeed.
And actually, you reference some of these approaches at a state level to, well, in effect, sort of compel coverage, and as you mentioned, was backed up by levies and other suggestions. But how could you, I mean, on the assumption that some of these initiatives succeed, do you then foresee a difficulty emerging with the reinsurance cover that sits behind these insurers? I mean, is there any precedent in terms of how they would be brought into the process?
I can see that it would be important for the London market reinsurers to be seen to be active if this guarantee fund or this levy is introduced, because I can see that the levy will be on the insurers in that state, but that the insurers in that state will only be looked to contribute the net loss, and therefore the state will look to the reinsurers, or the insurers will look to the reinsurers to meet the liabilities that will have been created by statute. So I think it's important for reinsurers to engage in this process now rather than face huge bill when the state has determined the position and the guarantee fund has only paid the difference between the coverage and the reinsurance, at which point it will not be open to the London market reinsurers to test their liability. It will have been determined at state level. So I would encourage the market not to sit back and await the outcome. And I suspect many people are already engaged. Many of the members of the London market are, of course, owned by US entities anyway. So I suspect they are well engaged. But those who aren't, I think, should actively engage in establishing exactly how this is going to work and how their exposure is going to be determined for fear that it will be too late to question it at some future stage. We've seen that happen with some mass litigation in the US that eventually works its way through the Jones into the London market, and it's then too late to reopen some of the questions that are best dealt with very early on, in my view.
Jonathan, focusing still on the US, and some investors in the sector seem to be drawing a distinction between carriers where virus or pandemics are explicitly excluded from their policies against those where a pandemic may not be specifically excluded, but where, for example, they stipulate there has to be physical damage for BI to be triggered. And of course, carriers with the latter still maintain the position that they're not therefore exposed to BI from COVID-19. But do you see the distinction that some are making? I mean, and if so, how important do you think that may prove to be?
Those issues have been debated in the US and to a lesser extent here. At the end of the day, you don't get to first base if you've got a pandemic exclusion. So the insurers would quite rightly say we didn't provide cover where there was a pandemic. And that should be the end of the matter, subject to state intervention and or some peculiarities of particular policies. Those who don't have pandemic exclusions will be looking at the physical damage business interruption point, the equivalent of a denial of access clause. I haven't looked very closely at US policies, so I'm no expert on those. But that would be a very different debate, because if there's no pandemic exclusion and we're only looking at what a particular court has to say about a particular exclusion, assuming that there isn't state intervention, I can see that different courts with different juries will come up with different decisions, whether it is COVID is a natural disaster or not, the extent to which it is covered under language that might otherwise not have been intended. It can be a very different and complicated debate in the US, as I say, in front of different courts in many different corners of the country with different juries, looking perhaps sympathetically at the position of a well-loved local business.
Indeed. And actually, the sort of plaintiff bar historically has shown a sort of degree of sort of entrepreneurial spirit in pursuing, kicking new angles or lines of attack against insurers, as history has demonstrated. I mean, with that in mind, I mean, do you expect the sort of plaintiff bar to take that similar approach? What particular kind of lines of attack do you think they may pursue?
I don't think there's any secret about the fact that there are plenty of cases already filed in the US, lots of arguments being raised about the extent of coverage against insurers, and I would not be surprised to see all sorts of different pockets being looked at, deep pockets, multiple pockets, the whole insurance chain, not something that I would be involved in, but I have seen in the past defending those claims in a variety of ways. How you get a fairly broad brush approach by the plaintiff bar, joining those people that they consider to be relevant, and that could comprise a fairly long list, everything from employer, if appropriate, to insurance agent, to cover holder, to broker, to placing broker, producing broker, ultimately insurer, etc. So I think the plaintiff bar, we can expect that the plaintiff bar will be very creative in this area, and I think if we get the FCA determination on the wording in England quite quickly, I don't think we'll get anything like that in the US if the plaintiff bar is allowed to pursue the claims without any state intervention. And the state intervention has, of course, many disadvantages and will be itself challenged, but it will at least head off some aspect of the endless litigation we could otherwise face in every corner of the US.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was going to ask that, to what extent should the insurance industry be sort of troubled by the various moves by the states to intervene? I mean, it sounds like there could at least be a silver lining in the sense that if they did succeed, there may be some clarity on cover, but presumably that wouldn't be to the benefit of the industry. I mean, is that a fair summary? I mean,
I'm not really qualified to comment on the US system. I've always practiced in England, so I better understand how things fit here. I, of course, have seen in reinsurance disputes consequences of the innovative and creative behavior of the plaintiff bar in the US. I would hope that we would be able to get down to a limited number of issues to be resolved, either by state intervention, which, as I say, has major disadvantages, or perhaps more importantly, if there were some kind of simple way forward where particular issues were resolved by ideally qualified judges to determine these issues. But again, the US court system is very different from ours, so that may not be available.
We'll wait and see. And also waiting to see, I mean, we referenced early on the morass of litigation that emerged from the World Trade Center attacks after 9/11. But ultimately, there was one positive from all this litigation, which is that the insurance industry fully embraced contract certainty. I wonder, looking for potential silver linings, whether you expect there to be any sort of positive long-term consequences of the disputes which are emerging from COVID-19.
From the market's point of view, they will be putting aside the litigation for the moment. I think there will be some advantages in that. I think online trading or trading platforms will be more commonly used. People will be more used to communicating online or in different forms, such as conferences and the like. So I think that will be good. I think obviously the industry will price its products appropriately, bearing in mind the uncertainty. After all, this is an industry that's been around for many, in some cases, hundreds of years. And so they understand the risks of pandemics. They understand the cost of providing cover for pandemics. So, you know, that's a view of the market. But if you want to know the long-term consequences of the disputes particularly, obviously, there will be more attention paid to the actual wording. Contract certainty, of course, is designed primarily to ensure that there's a contract in place, but as to what that contract says is determined by the negotiating position of the parties, the buyer or the seller. And so, yes, the underwriters will be able to tighten their wordings for as long as the market is hard and is in that state of flow, if you like. As soon as the market softens, the negotiating position will change. The insureds and reinsureds will be able to negotiate less restrictive conditions and or different terms. I can't see there being any room for uncertainty on the future drafting of business interruption clauses. I don't think anyone contemplated that there'd be so much attention paid to those clauses. So I suspect they'll get a good working over in the next few months so that there's no uncertainty. There may also be the possibility of a countrywide, certainly the UK solution, a sort of full re-equivalent, pandemic re-equivalent, which will provide some cover for pandemics. But you know, we've got a flood re, a pool re, and we could have a pandemic re. There are similar systems in different parts of the world to protect against natural catastrophes where the underwriting capacity is limited. But you do wonder how many of those you eventually create. So I think the market will eventually balance itself out. The relative strengths and weaknesses of the market will influence the extent to which the clauses do the job they're expected to do.
And I'm assuming more exclusions is one other outcome. Is that a sort of fair conclusion to draw?
Yes, I mean, an exclusion is only there to protect the underwriter from being exposed to the risk that they didn't write. So it's quite proper for there to be exclusions. What the buyer and seller needs to understand, and certainly the broker negotiating it needs to understand, is what the extent of the cover is that they've actually bought. And as I said earlier, if the cover on the face of it appears more broader than was intended and there isn't an appropriate exclusion, that's a risk for insurers. I've seen attempts to draft contracts for many, many years as a lawyer. Most of the time you cover all eventualities, but no one contemplated COVID and the breadth of COVID. So next time around, we'll all be wiser once again until something else happens where we'll find new wisdom.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm afraid we've run out of time for any more questions. So on behalf of the insurer and the Best Policy team, thank you. And I hope we get another opportunity to hear your thoughts before too long.